Radio 4 at very nearly 4 minutes past three. Now, The 39 Steps by John Buchan, dramatised for radio by Peter Buckman, with David Rintoul as Richard Hannay. The 39 Steps.
What orders, Captain Hardy?
Let's go and get him, Sergeant Major.
Halt!
There was no prouder man on earth than Richard Hannay when he took his Lennox Highlanders over the parapets on that glorious and bloody September day. Yet the worst bit of the campaign was a tea party to the show I had been in before the war started.
Did you do what I told you and get into Kiev bonds?
My man says he wouldn't touch anything in the Balkans.
Kiev's in Russia, Clive, and Russia's safe enough. People always fuss about the Balkans, but this'll blow over, like all the others. Don't you think so, Mr. Hannay?
I only know when the experts agree on something, it's pretty well bound to be wrong.
They're all saying Germany's no threat to us.
Exactly.
Nothing's going to happen, Clive. Why, this chap Kadalides...
Who?
Don't you ever read the papers?
Haven't the time, Frank. I pick up all I need to know at the club.
Then you should have picked up the fact that Kadalides, who is the Greek Prime Minister, is the one man to make sure things stay quiet in his part of the world. If anyone can keep the peace, he can.
What do you think, Hannay?
I beg your pardon?
You've knocked around there a bit, haven't you?
I've never been near the place.
Oh. But you have been abroad.
Not very good on geography, are you, Clive? Mr. Hannay's retired from South Africa. Something to do with prospecting, wasn't it?
Mining engineer, actually.
Find any gold?
A bit.
I say, are you a millionaire?
Afraid not.
Oh, well, I was introduced to a chap the other day, made a million selling sultanas.
Cornered the market, did he? Well,
something to do with jam, I think.
I'd been 3 months in the old country and was fed up with it. The talk of the ordinary Englishman made me sick. The weather made me liverish. I couldn't get enough exercise, and the amusements of London seemed as flat as soda water that's been standing in the sun. On my way back to the flat I'd hired near Portland Place, I gave half a crown to a beggar because I saw him yawn. He was a fellow sufferer. I vowed I'd give the place one more day to fit me into something. If nothing happened, I'd take the next boat back to the Cape. I was just opening my front door.
May I speak to you? Can I come in for a minute?
I recognized him as the little man who lived in the top floor flat. He seemed to be controlling himself with an effort.
Gave me a bit of a start there.
But come in.
There's nobody else here.
Not a soul. My man Paddock goes off at 7 and comes back in the morning. I can't stand servants living on the premises.
You don't mind if I chain the door.
All right. What's this about?
Say, mind if I have a drink?
No. Come through. Help yourself.
Thanks. Listen, I know it's a mighty liberty, but you look the kind of man who'd understand. Will you do me a good turn?
I'll listen to you. That's all I promise.
You must pardon me if I seem a bit rattled. You see, I happen at this moment to be dead.
Uh-huh. And what does it feel like?
No, I'm not mad, not yet. Listen, I reckon you're an honest man who's not afraid of playing a bold hand, so I'm going to confide in you. I need help worse than any man ever needed it. And I want to know if I can count you in.
Get on with your yarn and I'll tell you.
Does the name Kadalides mean anything to you?
Heard of him. At the center of this new Balkan crisis they're all shouting about, isn't he? Our people seem to have a lot of faith in him. I gather he's not quite so popular with the gentlemen east of the Rhine.
Well, you can say that again. In fact, Mr. Kadalides is right in their sights. Oh, I'm telling you, sir, I I'm afraid I don't have the privilege of your name.
Richard Hannay.
Well, Mr. Hannay, what is going on is much bigger than governments. There are capitalists, anarchists, and financiers out there plotting to make millions by setting the civilized nations at each other's throats. Karalithis is one of the few who can stop them. And that's why they've marked him down.
How do you know all this?
Give me another drink and I'll tell you.
I'll join you.
Thank you. Carry on, Mr.
Scudder. Franklin P. Scudder. I spent the last year on their trail. I got the first hint in an inn on the Achensee in Tyrol. I collected another clue in a fur shop in the Galician quarter of Buda. Another from the Strangers Club in Vienna, and a fourth in a bookshop off the Rachnestrasse in Leipzig. 10 days ago, I completed my evidence in Paris. They are going to murder Karalithis when he comes here on an official visit on June the 15th. 1 month from now.
Why wait till then?
I think Greasy's got bodyguards who'd kill their grandmothers if they laid a finger on him. But in London, where he's just one more foreign dignitary...
If you're so sure, why don't you warn him off coming?
What? And play their game? No. He's the only man who can sort things out. If he doesn't come, they've won.
Then tip off the British. Surely the police...
The whole of Scotland Yard couldn't save him from these people. They're not playing for beans, my friend. Listen, the killer will be an Austrian, which will make it look as if Vienna and Berlin are involved. Then Russia will go to war with Germany and... all hell will break loose. Unless Franklin P. Scudder is there to stop it. As long as I can stay alive till June 15th.
Are they on to you?
I thought I'd pretty well muddied my trail until last night. There was someone I sort of recognized hanging about this block. Then I found a card in my letterbox. From the man I want least to meet on God's earth. And that's when, Mr. Hannay, I knew I had to die.
I was wondering when we'd get round to that.
It's easy enough to get hold of a corpse in London. I hid it in my room and got myself up to look like death. I'm no slouch when it comes to disguises. Then I told my valet that I was feeling pretty bad and sent him home. After that, all I had to do was blow the corpse's jaw away with my revolver, dress it in my pajamas, and leave it on my bed. Since then, I've been waiting around for you to come home. I'm mighty glad I was to see you, too.
And I take it you want to lie low here for a while?
If you'll let me. I couldn't think of anywhere else.
Mm. What kind of people are they who are out to get you?
Well, they're in with the highest, I can tell you that. People you wouldn't suspect in a million years. They call themselves the Black Stone.
The what?
The Black Stone, Mr. Hannay, and I can assure you it's no laughing matter. There's a woman, decoy, to attract Karalithis. She goes under the name Yulia Tsaichenyi. There's a man with a lisp. And then... well, I've met some pretty tough characters in my time, but there's this old man with a young voice who can hoot his eyes like a hawk. Just to think about him makes my flesh crawl.
Hmm. You've got proof, I suppose.
It's all down in my little black book. That's what'll scupper them, Mr. Hannay. As long as I survive to tell the tale.
You've told me the wildest yarn I've ever heard, Mr. Scudder. But in my experience, the steepest stories often turn out to be true. I'm prepared to believe you're straight, though I should warn you that if you're not, I'm pretty handy with a gun.
I'd expect no less, sir.
Very well. I'll make you up a bed in the back room. Paddock comes in at 8. What shall I tell him?
You can tell him that your old friend, Captain Theophilus Digby of the 40th Gurkhas, has come to spend some of his leave with you.
Well, Captain Digby, I think it's about time to turn in, don't you?
I went to bed more cheerful than I had been for the past month. Things did happen occasionally, even in this godforsaken metropolis. The police soon found the corpse he prepared, and the papers were full of it. And over the next few days, Scudder told me a whole lot more about the business, though to tell you the truth, I was less interested in the politics than in his adventures. He spent most of his time reading and smoking and scribbling in his little black book. Then one night I came home about 9:30 for our usual game of chess, at which Scudder always beat me hollow.
Scudder? Are you there, old man? Scudder.
What I saw made me fall into a cold sweat. My guest was lying sprawled on his back. There was a long knife through his heart, which skewered him to the floor. I'd seen men die before. I'd even killed a few myself, but this cold-blooded indoor murder was different. I covered poor Scudder's staring face with a tablecloth and swallowed several mouthfuls of brandy. Then I sat down to think. It was pretty clear I was in the soup. If I went to the police, they'd probably charge me with Scudder's murder, and I had no pal to speak up for me. Even if I stayed out of jail, it was obvious I'd be the next target on the assassin's list. Yet I felt pretty well bound to carry on Scudder's work. You may think that ridiculous, considering the danger I was in. I'm an ordinary sort of fellow, and certainly no braver than anyone else, yet I hated to see a good man downed. That's what decided me to vanish for the next 3 weeks. When I knew Karolides was safely on his way, I would go to the powers that be and tell them Scudder's story. Maybe they'd believe me, maybe they wouldn't. But the prospect of some action at last comforted me enormously. The first thing was to find Scudder's little black book. I searched the body in vain and went through the flat with a tooth comb, not a trace. I supposed that the enemy had got hold of it. Then I looked at an atlas for a likely place to vanish in, a wild district where at least my Veldkraft would be of some use. I settled on Scotland, for my people were Scotch, and I could pass anywhere as an ordinary Scotsman. There was an early morning train which would get me to Galloway by the late afternoon. The only problem was how to get to St. Pancras without being spotted. Still puzzling at this, I went to bed. Some 3 or 4 troubled hours of sleep later, I woke as the first rays of morning light were beginning to filter through the shutters. I hunted out an old tweed suit, a flannel shirt, and some strong nailed boots, and stuffed a spare shirt, a cloth cap, some handkerchiefs, and a toothbrush into my pockets. I put £50 in gold sovereigns into a money belt and breakfasted off a whiskey and soda and some biscuits. Then I thought I'd better fill my tobacco pouch. I was poking around the tobacco jar when I felt something small and hard inside it. I drew it out. It was Scudder's little black book. That seemed a good omen. I lifted the cloth I'd put over Scudder's body and was amazed at the peace and dignity of the dead face. Then I sat back and waited. Goodbye, old chap. I'm going to do my best for you. Wish me well, wherever you are.
Milkman, can you spare a minute?
Right, old chap. Yeah?
You look a sporting kind of chap. I've got a bit of a bet on. Lend me your cap and overall for 10 minutes, and there's a sovereign for you.
A quid, Gov? The rig's yours.
There you are. Oh. Now, just keep mum for 10 minutes, will you?
10 minutes, ease.
Good man.
At first, I thought there was nobody in the street. Then I caught sight of a policeman 100 yards down, and a loafer shuffling past on the other side. Some impulse made me raise my eyes to the house opposite, and there at the first floor window was a face. As the loafer passed, he looked up, and it may have been my fancy, but I'm pretty certain a signal was exchanged. I can tell you, as soon as I rounded the corner...
If it's a Glasgow train you want, you missed it.
Not yet, I haven't!
Ticket, please.
Oh, I didn't quite have time.
This is first class, you know.
Well,
you better come along with me.
What for?
Third class is more your line, I'd have thought. Come on, this way, if you please.
He marched me off to a compartment occupied by a morose sailor and a stout woman with a small child.
Here you are. Third class smoker. Now, Where are you going? Do you know or don't you? I haven't got all day, you know.
I'll tuck a single to Newton Stewart.
Now we're getting somewhere. Newton Stewart. Right, here you are. And next time, try to buy a ticket before you catch train. It'll save us all a lot of bother.
It's a safe fact, catching trains.
Gert needed a scotch tongue to put him in his place. He was complaining of this woman's way no hain a ticket and her no yet flower.
Impudence.
And he objected to me spitting.
So my new life started in an atmosphere of protest against authority. I reminded myself that a week ago I had been finding the world dull. I waited until Leeds to get a luncheon basket, and after I'd eaten, I settled down to study Scudder's little book. It was full of names and figures which made no sense to me, but I was sure there was a cipher involved. I thought I was pretty good at such things, and I worried away at it for hours until I fell asleep. And woke up, none the wiser, at Dumfries, just in time to bundle out and get into the slow Galloway train, which rumbled into a land of little wooded glens, and then into a great wide moorland place, gleaming with lochs. I got out at a forgotten little station and struck out along the road. It was a gorgeous spring evening, with every hill showing as clear as a cut amethyst. The air had the queer, rooty smell of bogs, but it was as fresh as mid-ocean, and it actually made me feel light-hearted. If you believe me, I was like a boy out for a holiday tramp rather than a man of 37 very much wanted by the police. I spent the night in a herdsman's cottage, and the following day I doubled back on my tracks in order to foil any pursuers. I picked up a local train and found a compartment that was empty but for a sleeping shepherd and his dog. There was a copy of The Scotsman on the seat, but though there were two columns on the so-called Portland Place murder, there was nothing about identifying the murderer. I was feeling pretty confident until we slowed down at the station where I'd got out the day before, and I saw the station master being interviewed by three men, one of whom was busily taking notes. I sat well back, though I couldn't help smiling when I saw them stare solemnly at the road I'd walked the day before. If they were the local police, I'd given them the slip for a while longer, since the train soon picked up speed. And then my sleeping companion, who was plainly very drunk, woke up.
Have we passed through Paulnacky?
Aye.
That's what comes of being a teetotaler.
That's a fact.
Aye, and a strangian. I took the pledge last Martinmas, and I hain't touched a drop of whiskey since then. No, even at Hogmanay, though I was sair tempted. That's all I get. I heed hotter than hell fire and twa een looking different ways for the Sabbath.
What did it?
A drink they call brandy. Being a teetotaler, I keep it half the whiskey, but I was nipping all day at this brandy. I'll no be weel for a fortnight.
My plan had been to get out at a station down the line, but the train gave me a better opportunity, for it came to a halt at the end of a culvert. I looked out. My companion still slept. No one else appeared, so I opened the door and dropped quickly into the hazel bushes that fringed the line. And it would have been all right, but for the shepherd's infernal dog.
Help, dog! There's a man here trying to kill himself!
Where is it? Let's get on, let me stop.
There's a body on the line!
I could not have made a more public departure had I left with a bugle and a brass band. However, the shepherd luckily provided a diversion. Somehow or other, he fell from the train with his dog, which promptly bit the guard who jumped down to help. I crawled through the undergrowth for about a quarter of a mile, and when I looked back, the train had started again and was vanishing into the distance. I was alone in a landscape as peaceful as any in the world. Yet for the first time, I felt the terror of the hunted. I knew that plane was looking for me. I also knew it did not belong to the police. I began to think less well of the countryside I had chosen to hide in. These heather hills were no good if my enemy was in the sky. What I needed was a house.
As when a griffin through the wilderness, with winged step o'er hill and moory dale, pursues the Arimaspian.
Good evening.
Oh, good evening to you. It's a fine night for the road.
Is this place an inn?
It is, sir, and I am the landlord. I hope you'll stay the night, for to tell you the truth, I've had no company for a week.
You're young to be an innkeeper, are you not?
Yeah, my father died and left me this business. Oh. It wasn't my first choice of profession.
Which was?
I want to write books.
Man, I've often thought that an innkeeper should make the best storyteller in the world.
No, not now. Maybe in the old days when you had pilgrims and ballad makers and highwaymen on the road, but now nobody comes here but motor cars full of fat women who stop for lunch and a fisherman or two or the shooting tenants in the August. There's not much material to be got out of that.
You think that adventure is found only in the tropics or among gentry in red shirts? Maybe you're rubbing shoulders with it at this moment.
Confound romance and all unseen romance brought up the 9:15, eh?
I've a true tale for you, then. And a month from now, you can make a novel out of it. So, there you have it. You're looking for adventure, and here I brought it to you. The devils are after me, and the police are after them. I tell you, it's a race I mean to win, and shall, with your help.
It is pure Conan Doyle.
You believe me?
Of course I do. I believe everything out of the common. It's the normal one ought to distrust.
I reckon they're off my track for the moment, but I must lie low for a couple of days. Will you take me in?
You can lie as snug here as if you were in a moss hole, and I'll see that no one blabs. You can trust me.
I was safe for a while, and once I'd sent the young innkeeper off each morning to fetch the papers, I had time to settle down to Scudder's notebook in earnest. It was the key word I couldn't find, until the name Juliet Sechenyi suddenly flashed across my memory. She was the decoy for Karolides, Scudder had said, and the five letters of her first name gave me the position of the vowels, as her surname gave me the numbers for the main consonants. In half an hour I was able to decipher Scudder's notes, and I read, with a whitish face and fingers drumming on the table.
Are you the innkeeper?
I am. Can I help you?
Got anyone staying?
More to the point. Got a whiskey and soda?
This way, gentlemen.
Who is it?
It's me. There's two chaps in the dining room having whiskies and sodas. They asked all about you and said they hoped to meet you here.
You're certain it's me they're after?
They described you right down to your shirt and boots. But don't worry, I told them you were here last night and went off on a motorcycle this morning.
How did they take that?
The dark one swore like a navvy.
What do they look like?
There's a thin fellow with bushy brows, dark hair and dark eyes. The other one's fat and smiles all the time. Oh, aye, and he's got a lisp.
A lisp? Would you say either of them was, well, foreign?
As English as the king, both of them.
Right. We'll send them off on a bit of a wild goose chase. Take this down and say you found it in my room. Suggest they return it to me if they catch me up. Here.
Leave it to me.
In German, I'd written as if it were part of a letter. The American had got onto this, but he could not act for a fortnight. I doubt if I can do any good now, especially as Karolides is uncertain about his plans. I will do the best I can, but if the Black Stone...
The dark chap went white as death and swore like blazes while the fat one whistled and looked far from pleased. They gave me half a sovereign for the drinks and wouldn't even wait for the change.
Excellent. Now, this is what I'd like you to do. Cycle over to Newton Stewart and get hold of the chief constable. Give him a detailed description of those two men and say you think they have something to do with the Portland Place murder. You can swear you heard them talking about it. Tell him you think they'll be back, and they will, I promise you, when they discover they're on a false trail. And get the police to send a few men over, bright and early. Have you got all that?
I think so.
Off you go, then.
But what if I'm not believed?
My dear fellow, you have to be something of an actor if you want people to believe in the characters in your books. Here's an excellent opportunity to practice.
He went off like a lamb while I puzzled out the rest of Scudder's notes. What I discovered was that I'd been told a pack of lies. All that stuff about a conspiracy of financiers and anarchists was eyewash. But the 15th of June was going to be a day of destiny much bigger than the killing of a foreign politician. I saw why Scudder had tried to fob me off. He'd stumbled on something so vast he wanted to keep the credit for himself. And in a strange way, that made me believe him even more. I smoked in a chair till daylight, for I could not sleep.
Mr. Baird?
Yes?
Chief Constable sent us about the Portland Place murder.
Now that's right, officer. Why don't you put your car in the coach house? Then you and your men can hide in the inn.
20 minutes later, I saw from my window a second car approach. It stopped 200 yards off in the shelter of a wood. Then two men got out.
Good morning to you, gentlemen.
Morning. Has he returned?
Who do you mean?
You know very well who we mean, my friend.
I scribbled a quick line of thanks to my host, opened the window, dropped quietly into the bushes, and made my way unobserved to the car at the far edge of the wood. Over the roar of that 40-horsepower engine, I fancied that the wind brought me the sound of angry voices. I drove that car for all she was worth across the crisp roads on that shining May morning, all the while thinking about Scudder's notes, especially the little bits that made no sense, like the phrase that occurred half a dozen times inside brackets, 39 steps, it said. And the last time he used it, he'd added 39 steps. I counted them. High tide, 10:17 p.m. About midday, I drove into a village and thought I might stop and eat. However, I noticed a policeman outside the post office, reading a telegram with the postmistress. They looked up as they heard me approach.
Excuse me a minute, sir. Hey, you! Stop! Stop!
My friends back at the inn must have been more persuasive than I thought. From now on, I kept to the loneliest roads. As evening drew in, I was beginning to think seriously of something to eat and a place to hide out for the night, when, only a mile or so to the south, coming straight towards me and flying low, all I could think of was to get to the leafy cover of the valley. I went like blue lightning. Of course, I tried to avoid the other car, but I smashed straight through the hedge. Fortunately, I managed to grab hold of a branch before the 1,000-guinea tour I had borrowed tipped over and crashed into the stream below.
I say, are you all right?
The voice belonged to a tall young man in goggles and a leather ulster.
Bless my soul, I thought you were a goner. I'm most frightfully sorry about your car. Look as if it had it.
The fault is mine, sir. I'd call it a stroke of luck. I didn't kill you. Never mind myself.
Yeah. Look here, I'm in a bit of a hurry, but you're the right sort of fellow, and I can spare a quarter of an hour. My house is just round the corner. I'll see you clothed and fed and put to bed till you feel right. I suppose your kit's in the burn along with the car.
It's in my pocket. I'm a colonial and travel light.
A colonial? Bless my soul, you're the very fellow I've been praying for, begad. Are you by any blessed chance a free trader?
I am.
Then get into my car, my dear fellow. You can choose any one of my suits and take a snack in your pocket. We'll have supper when we get back.
Get back from where?
I've got to be at the Masonic Hall at 8 o'clock... to address a meeting on free trade. I had a colonial ex-premier coming, but he wired saying he'd got influenza. I'd planned to speak for 10 minutes. I had the devil's own job trying to find something that'll last 40. I'm the liberal candidate for this part of the world, which is an infernal Tory stronghold. So you see, Mr. You haven't told me your name, have you?
Twisdon.
Bless my soul, you're not related to old Tommy Twisdon of the 60th?
Afraid not.
Oh, never mind. As I was saying... And so, Mr. Chairman, we can dispense with the notion that Germany is a menace to British interests. On the contrary, were it not for the Tories, this country would be working side by side with Germany for that peace and reform that is the goal we all of us seek.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Sir Harry. Most instructive. And now I call upon that trusted leader of Australian thought, Mr. Twisdon.
And that is the reason, ladies and gentlemen, that there are no Tories in Australia. Only Labour and Liberals. But I can assure you, they all believe in that great idea we call the Empire.
Rubbish.
An idea we can make work gloriously if only we put our backs into it.
Altogether, I fancy I was rather a success, although I was praying all the time there wasn't an actual Australian present. My host, who was some orphan baronet with an uncle in the cabinet, was pathetically grateful, and at last we got back to the supper he'd promised me. I'd only had 2 buns all day, and what with that and escaping death by inches, I was devilishly hungry. Afterwards, we went to drink grog in a cheery smoking room with a crackling wood fire, and I determined to take Sir Harry into my confidence. Despite his politics, I could see by his eye that he was a fellow to trust.
Look here, Sir Harry. You don't believe that poisonous rubbish you spouted on the platform tonight, do you?
Oh, dear me, was it as bad as that? I suppose it might have been rather thin.
But you surely don't think Germany would go to war with us?
Ask me that question in 6 weeks, and it won't need an answer. In that bright room with the deer's heads and old prints on the wall, I told him the whole story, including the cracking of Scudder's code. I think I needed to sort it out in my own mind so that when I went to face the government with it, it would make sense. And he listened.
So you see, Karolida is going to hand in his checks on the 15th of June, and nothing in the world can prevent it.
But if they kill him...
It's going to happen, and war is coming as sure as Christmas. According to Scudder, that's been arranged since 1912.
But we aren't ready for it.
Exactly. Karolida's death will upset the Balkans, and Vienna will get mightily excited. Then Russia will chip in, only to be calmed down by Berlin acting as peacemaker.
Then surely there won't be war.
Their plan is to lull us into a false sense of security, then find a cause for a quarrel and let fly at us when we're least prepared. While we're talking about their goodwill and good intentions, our coast will be silently ringed with mines, and submarines will be waiting for our every battleship.
So the Black Stone.
That's the most devilish part. France and Britain have got working plans for joint action in case of war. They've been making them quietly for some time between the 2 general staffs. Around the time of Karolida's visit, some great swell is coming from Paris to receive nothing less than a statement of the disposition of the British Home Forces on mobilization. The Black Stone intends to get hold of these plans and then use them against us at the first opportunity. If they succeed, Sir Harry, England will be conquered within days, if not hours.
What can I do?
You said earlier you had an uncle in the cabinet. You could write him a letter. I've got to talk to somebody high up before the 15th of June.
I'll do better than that. This is Foreign Office business, and my godfather happens to be permanent secretary there. Capital fellow, name of Sir Walter Bullivant. He'll be fishing on the Kennet now. What do you want me to say?
Tell him if a man called Twisden turns up, mentions the Black Stone, and whistles Annie Laurie, he should treat him kindly.
Consider that done. What else?
You can lend me an old suit and let me look at a map. I'll make for the moors, and it would be as well to know the lie of the land.
You shall have the pick of my wardrobe.
Thank you. And if the police come seeking me, just show them the car in the glen. If the other lot turn up, tell them I caught the South Express after your meeting. Now, have you a bicycle?
Daylight found me pedalling diligently up steep roads into a wide green world towards the high mountains I hoped would be my sanctuary. But around 7 o'clock, there wasn't cover for a tom-tit on those round-shouldered hills. The free moorlands were now prison walls, and the keen air was the breath of a dungeon. I chucked my bicycle into a bog and took to the heather on foot until I saw, not 2 miles off, a row of men advancing towards me like beaters at a shoot. Now, if you are hemmed in on all sides, there is only one chance of escape. You must stay in the patch and let your enemies search it and not find you. Good sense. But how was I to escape notice in that tablecloth of a place? There was nothing but short heather, bare hills, and the white highway. Then, around a bend, beside a heap of stones...
Confound the day I ever left the herding. Oh, there I was, my ain maester. Now I'm a slave to the government. Tethered to the roadside with serene and a back like a sickle. Oh, mercy on me, my heat's burst. Ach, the surveyor man, just report me. I'm for my bed.
He was a wild figure, about my own size, with a week's growth of beard and big horn spectacles.
What ails you, man?
Oh, the trouble is that I'm no sober. Last night, my Dr. Merrin was wadded, and they danced all four in the byre. Me and some other chiels sat down to the drinking, and here I am. Oh, 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 it's a pity that I ever look it on the wine when it was red.
Bad sounds like a good idea.
Well, it's easy speaking, but I got a postcard yestreen saying that the new road surveyor would be round the day. He'll come and he'll no find me, or else he'll find me fool. And either way, I'm a done man.
Could you not say you weren't a wheel?
Oh, I doubt that'll no help me, for they ken my kind of no wheelness.
Aye. Does the new surveyor know you?
Know him. Oh, no, he's just been a week at the job. He runs about in a wee motor car and... Ach, he would spear the inside out of your whelk.
Where's your house?
Do near by the stream.
Now, what about your bed? I'll take on your job for a bit and see the surveyor.
Oh. Peter, man, you're the billy. Oh, it'll be easy enough managed. I'll finish that bing of stains, so you need not chop any mare this forenoon. Just tack the barra and wheel the nyuch metal for your own quarry down the road to make another bing the morn.
What name do you go by?
Alexander Turnbull. Though my friends just call me Specky, for the glasses I wear, being weak in the sect. I've been 7 years at the trade, and 20 afore that, herding on Leith and Water. Just you speak the surveyor fair, and call him sir, and... he'll be fell pleased. I'll be back or midday.
Give me your hat and your glasses in case he's heard about you. And you tuck my coat and waistcoat.
I'd better look the part. Oh, here, tuck my dinner and all. It is only a bite of cheese, but you're welcome to it. And the paper, though it is 6 days old.
You won't have your sleep. I'll manage fine.
By kicking my boots against the stones, I made them look a bit more like a roadman's, for I had to play the part in front of people who wouldn't miss a trick. I tied my trousers with string, rubbed dirt into my face and neck and eyes so that I looked properly bleary, and bit and scraped my fingernails till they were black and uneven. An old scout I knew in Rhodesia, called Peter Pinar, told me that the secret of playing a role was to think yourself into it. I took that wheelbarrow down to the quarry and concentrated on being an awkward cove who lived in a little riverside cottage with a bottle of cheap whiskey for company. Nothing appeared on that long white road, and I soon grew warm enough to think longingly of evening and the end of this monotony. I was so engrossed, I didn't hear the car.
Are you Alexander Turnbull?
I saw a round-faced young man in a bowler hat sitting in a little Ford two-seater.
I'm the new county road surveyor. Are you charge of the section from Laidlaw Byres to the Riggs? Good. A fair bit of road, Turnbull. Not badly engineered. A little soft about a mile off, though. And the edges want cleaning. See to it. Good morning.
Obviously, my get-up was good enough to fool the dreaded surveyor. But my next visitors were more of a challenge. There were three men in the car, and I recognized two of them from my shelter with the literary innkeeper. The third had the look of a countryman, with eyes as bright and wary as a hen's.
Morning.
Eh?
That's a fine, easy job of yours.
There's war jobs and there's better. I'd rather have yours sitting all day in your hinterlands and they cushions.
Oh, would you indeed?
It's you and your muckle cars that wreck my roads. If we all had our rechts, you should be made to mend for your brock.
Sure, Miss Stephens.
What's he saying?
My friend was just admiring your boots.
Those were never made by a country shoemaker.
Indeed, they were not.
Where did you get them?
What business is it of yours?
Oh, you can tell us. We'll no report ye.
Report me, indeed. These boots were made in London and given me by the gentleman that was here last year for the shooting.
East in Ordnance.
Let's go.
One more question. Did you see anyone pass this way early this morning?
Well,
did you or didn't you?
I wasn't out very early. You see, my daughter was married last night, and we keeping it up late. I opened the house door about 7, and there was nobody on the road then. Since then, there's just been the baker and the road surveyor beside you, gentlemen.
Thank you, my friend. Drive on.
I continued wheeling my barrow, which was just as well, since the car returned to check up on me. Those gentry left nothing to chance. I finished my pile of stones and also my roadman's lunch, and wondered what to do next. At 5 o'clock I decided to walk down to Turnbull's cottage to reclaim my own clothes and try to get over the hills in the darkness. But a few hundred yards down the road, there was another car. Its driver was occupied in trying to light a cigarette out of the wind. A sudden daftness overtook me.
Well met, my lad.
By an amazing chance, I knew the driver, Marmaduke Jopley.
Who the devil are you?
He was a sort of high-class marriage broker, an offence to creation, and the most crashing snob who'd crawl to anyone with a title.
What are you doing in my car?
You remember me, Hanny. Came to you with an introduction from Rhodesia. You're kind enough to dine me at your club.
Hanny? But good God, you're the Portland Place murderer.
Just so, and there'll be a second murder, my dear, if you don't do as I tell you.
What? What? You wouldn't...
Just give me that fine leather ulster and those driving gloves of yours, my dear fellow. And the cap, too, if you don't mind. You can have mine.
That filthy hat, I couldn't...
Of course you could, Jopley. Why, it'll suit you. Put it on, man.
I'd really rather not.
You don't want to upset me, do you? Put it on, I say, and leave it there.
Yes. Yes, very well. There.
Very nice, my dear. You look almost human. While I, thanks to your togs, am the best-dressed motorist in Scotland...
What are you going to do?
We're going for a little ride, Marmy. You'll like that, won't you? Just sit quite still like a good little boy and no harm will come to you.
But
open your mouth, my child, or try even the slightest of tricks, and as sure as there's a God above, I'll wring your neck. Savvy?
I savvy.
I enjoyed that evening's ride. We passed through several villages, and I couldn't help noticing some strange-looking folk lounging by the roadside who would doubtless have had something to say if they'd recognized me. But soon we'd left villages, farms, and cottages behind, and came to a lonely moor, where the night was blackening the sunset gleam in the bog pools.
What are you doing? You're not going to kill me and bury my body in this godforsaken place.
I'm an obliging fellow, Jopley, but I don't think I'll go that far. Here you are. I'll back that old hat, if you don't mind, unless you'd rather keep it.
No, no, I'm sure it looks far better on you. Here.
A thousand thanks. There's more use in you than I thought.
You're going to stay in this wilderness? Where will you sleep?
Don't you worry about me, Jopley. I'm going to disappear. Off you go now and tell the police what's happened to you.
You can be sure of that. I promise you.
I curled up in the heather and went to sleep, thinking that, though I was not a murderer, I'd become an unholy liar, a shameless impostor, and a highwayman with a marked taste for expensive motor cars. I awoke cold and hungry. Most of my stuff was still in Mr. Turnbull's keeping, including Scudder's notebook and, worst of all, my pipe and tobacco. I thought of all the meals I'd like to eat and settled on a porterhouse steak and a quart of bitter with Welsh rabbit to follow. Then I sat up to lace my boots and saw something that put hunger out of my mind. A quarter of a mile away, spread out like a fan, was a long line of men beating the heather. Jopley had been quicker off the mark than I'd expected. I enjoyed myself playing hare to their hounds, and the luck that I'd had so far gave me the feeling that I was going to get through. But though I've got long legs and sound wind, I'm not by nature a mountaineer. And the men who had me in their sights were hefty local farmers, at a guess, who would soon shorten the distance between us. But then I came to a well-maintained road that obviously led to a house. I took it and stopped in front of a glass veranda through which I could see an elderly gentleman calmly watching me.
You seem a little out of breath, my friend.
He was a benevolent old fellow with a round, shiny face like Mr. Pickwick's. He stopped writing when I entered but didn't get up. I couldn't find a word to say to him, so I just nodded towards his window, through which we could both see men half a mile off struggling through the heather.
I see. A fugitive from justice, eh? Well, we'll go into that later. I object to having my privacy disturbed by the clumsy rural policeman. Go through the hall into my study, and you will see two doors facing you. Take the one on the left and close it behind you. You will be perfectly safe. Go on.
I found myself in a little dark chamber that smelt of chemicals and had only a tiny window high up on one wall.
The door had swung shut behind me like the door of a safe. Once more I had found unexpected sanctuary, but I was not altogether easy. There was something about the old gentleman which puzzled and rather terrified me. He had been too easy and ready, almost as if he had expected me. And his eyes had been horribly intelligent. Not a sound came to me in that dark place. I tried to possess my soul in patience and forget how hungry I was. Then I took a more cheerful view. The old gentleman could scarcely refuse me breakfast. I fell to thinking about bacon and eggs, half a ton of bacon and 50 eggs to go with it. While my mouth was watering, the door opened, the sunlight flooded in, and there stood my host. Have they gone, sir?
I convinced them that you had crossed the hill. I have no desire to hand over to the police a man I am delighted to honour.
As he spoke, his eyelids seemed to tremble and fall over his keen grey eyes. I suddenly remembered Scudder's terror of the man who could hood his eyes like a hawk.
I bid you welcome, Mr. Richard Hannay.
My first impulse was to throttle the old ruffian and make for the open air, but he must have sensed my intention, for he smiled and nodded towards the door behind him. Looking round, I saw two servants who had me covered with pistols. Yet, though he might know my name, he had never seen me in person. I still had a slender chance.
Who's this Hannay? My name's Ainsley.
As you wish. We shan't quarrel over a name.
I was beginning to pull myself together and reflected that at least my clothes wouldn't betray me.
I suppose you're going to give me up after all. I call that a damn dirty trick.
No, I shall not give you up, Mr. Hannay. My friends and I will have a little private settlement with you, that's all.
Oh, I wish I'd never seen that cursed motor car. Here's the money, and be damned to you.
You know a little too much, Mr. Hannay. You are a clever actor, but not quite clever enough.
For God's sake, sir, what more can I do? I've not had a bit of luck since coming ashore at Leith. Everything's been against me. What's the harm in a poor devil with an empty stomach picking up some money he finds in a bust-up motor car? That's all I've done. And for that, I've been chivied and chased by those blasted bobbies all over these blasted hills. I tell you, I'm fair sick of it. You do what you like, old boy. Ned Ainsley's got no fight left in him.
Will you oblige me with the story of your recent doings?
I would, Governor, but I've not had a bite to eat for 48 hours. Give me a mouthful and something to wet my whistle, and then you'll hear. God's truth.
Carl, pastete und beer. So, proceed with your story.
I was fairly in character now. I'd even pretended to look blank when he fired a few words of German at me, so I had no trouble spinning a yarn.
I came over from Archangel a week ago, sir, to see my brother at Wigton. Being a bit short of cash, if you know what I mean, I had to go by Shanks's pony, and that's how I saw the car, sir, through a hole in the hedge.
Where was this?
About 12 miles out of Battleburn, Governor. Lying in a burn it was, and no sign of a soul. I was poking about to see what had happened, and I just happened to notice 3 sovereigns on the seat and 1 more on the floor. Well, sir, what would you do? I pocketed them, naturally. Though I wish to God I hadn't.
Go on.
Well, I tried to change one in a baker's shop, and the woman cried in the police. I thought I'd given them the slip and was having a drink from a pump when they nearly nabbed me. So up I left them holding my collar and coat, which is why I'm in this state.
You're a good liar, Hannay.
Stop fooling, damn you! I'd rather have a police than you with your Hannays and your monkeys with their pistols. No, Governor, I beg pardon, I didn't mean that. I'm much obliged to you for the pie and the beer, and I'll be even more obliged if you just let me go on my way to Wigton. The coast is clear.
I have no intention of letting you go. If you are what you say, you will soon have a chance of clearing yourself. If you are what I believe you to be, I do not think you will see the light much longer.
He looked steadily at me, and there was something so devilish about those eyes, something cold and clever and hellishly powerful, that I felt an impulse to throw myself on his mercy and offer to join his side. But I managed to stick it out. Just.
Carl! Im Keller! Schnell!
I sat in the chilly darkness of that cellar in a pretty miserable state of mind. No doubt the old boy had sent for his accomplices, and one of them was bound to recognize me as the roadman they'd interviewed yesterday. Once they put two and two together, what chance would I have? I thought wistfully of the police plodding after me in the wrong direction. The old devil had got rid of them pretty quickly. No doubt he had letters from cabinet ministers saying he was to be given every facility for plotting against us. That's the sort of owlish way we run politics in this jolly old country. Then I decided I wasn't going to give in without a fight. I began to explore the room, dark though it was, and I came across some sort of cupboard. I waited to see if my guards came running at the noise, but nothing happened. I felt around and found a box of matches. There was a stock of torches on a shelf. With their aid, I found all sorts of chemicals, yards of copper wire and yanks of oiled silk. But my most interesting discovery was a little wooden case. When I broke it open, I saw half a dozen little grey bricks, each a couple of inches square. Now, I'd been a mining engineer, and I knew it would only take one of these bricks to blow the whole house to smithereens. The trouble was, I couldn't remember exactly how you set the charge. I reckoned I had about a 5-to-1 chance of blowing myself into the trees. On the other hand, if I didn't get away, 10-to-1, I'd be in a 6-foot hole in the garden. It was about the beastliest moment of my life. But then I remembered poor Scudder. I built up a little barricade against the wall, put some explosive behind it, attached a fuse, and crouched down as far away as possible. Then I said a prayer. I think I became unconscious for a few seconds, but I managed to struggle out of the debris into the fresh air. I felt sick and ill, but I was still able to move, and I staggered blindly away from the house until I found an old stone dovecot. Somehow or other, I hauled myself up to the top, where there was a parapet behind which I could lie unseen. Then I proceeded to go off into an old-fashioned swoon. I woke with a burning head and the sun glaring in my face.
Here I
am! Nicht möglich!
Fulden!
Dort!
All that long, blistering afternoon as they searched for me, I lay there on the rooftop with nothing to eat or drink, praying for the coming of darkness. When night finally came, thank God there was no moon. I waited until the house was quiet, climbed shakily down, and crawled on my hands and knees, feeling every inch of the ground before me until I was sure I was clear of any alarms or tripwires. Once I was safe in the heather, I didn't stop until I had put a good half dozen miles between me and my enemies. And then the weather changed. I passed a pretty miserable night among the hills, but there were no stars to steer by, and if I wasn't sliding off rocks or tripping over heather roots, I was dragging myself out of peat bogs. I was hungry, my head ached, my shoulder hurt, and I must have looked a fine sight when I finally reached Mr. Turnbull's house.
What are you that comes stravigging here on the Sabbath morning?
Mr. Turnbull,
Mush! Man, you're terrible done in the legs. Hold up till I get you a chair.
Who can hood his eyes like a hawk?
39 steps.
My freeze gobby, Spicky.
15th of June.
I can't. I
do not think you will see the light much
more. High tide, 10:17 p.m. My ordeal had brought on a bout of malaria, something I'd picked up in Africa, and it was 10 whole days before I was fit again. During all that time, Turnbull looked after me like a true friend, without even asking my name. Indeed, he became downright surly when I insisted on paying him £5 for my lodging. You would have thought from our leave-taking that we'd parted in disgust, but the fateful 15th of June was fast approaching, and I had to make my way south to meet Sir Walter Bullivant of His Majesty's Foreign Office. I caught the midnight express from Moffat, and many travel-stained hours and half a dozen changes of train later, at 8 o'clock on the evening of the 13th of June, I found myself alighting at the little Berkshire station of Artenswell. I walked in a scented dusk through beech woods into a valley where chestnuts and lilac were in full bloom. Below a bridge, a huge man in untidy flannels and a wide-brimmed hat was fishing in the clear, slow stream.
Look at that big fella. £4 of his an ounce. The evening rise is over and I can't tempt him.
I don't see him.
There, yard from the reeds.
Now I've got him. You might swear he was a black stone.
Uh-huh. Twisden's the name, isn't it?
No. I mean, yes.
It's a wise conspirator that knows his own name. There's my house, 100 yards off. Go round to the back door. My butler will show you to your room. Dare say you could use a bath. Dinner in half an hour. You'll hear the gong.
Sir Walter did me proud, for fresh clothes were laid out for me, and we drank some good champagne with dinner. During the meal, he asked me no questions. All we discussed was sport up and down the globe. Then we went into his study, a jolly, comfortable room full of books and trophies and untidiness. I resolved to create one just like it if I ever got out of this business and had a place of my own. The coffee cups were cleared away. We got our cigars alight, and my host swung his legs over the side of his chair.
Well, I forbade my godson's instructions. In return, he promised me you'd tell me something to wake me up. I'm ready, Mr. Hannay.
I told him the whole tale from start to finish. When I'd done, he got up and confronted me from the hearthrug.
Well, let me put your mind at rest on one thing, at least. You are in no danger of being arrested.
Great Scott, you mean they've got the murderer?
No, but they've dropped you from the list of suspects.
Why?
Principally because I'd received a letter from Scudder on the 31st of May.
But he'd been dead a week by then.
Well, evidently he did not anticipate such an early demise. Now, his letters usually took a week to reach me. He had a mania for concealing his tracks. He was half genius, half crank, was Scudder. One of the bravest, yet always shivering with fright. Trouble was, he insisted on playing a lone hand, and that made him pretty well useless as a Secret Service man.
What did he say about me?
Enough to clear you, Mr. Hannay. You've got his notebook.
Right here.
We went through Scudder's notes. Sir Walter was very quick at picking up the cipher, and though he amended my reading in one or two places, I'd got the gist of it right. He sat silent for a while, looking very grave.
I wish I had more confidence in Scudder's judgment.
Don't you believe him, then?
Oh, he's right about the French high-up coming over to share our plans. That's happening the day after tomorrow. How it got known, I don't know, which is bad enough. But all this about war and the Black Stone. Scudder had a lot of odd prejudices, as well as an artistic temperament. The Black Stone. Der Schwarze Stein. It's a bit melodramatic, don't you think?
What about Karolides?
Well, that's the weakest part. No one in Europe wants to get rid of him. He'll outlast both of us, Hannay. He's in London now with not a whisper of trouble. Oh, Scudder's gone off the rails there, I'm afraid.
Excuse me, Sir Walter, but there's a trunk call from London, and Mr. Heath, sir, wants to speak to you personally.
Oh, very well, Whittaker. Forgive me, Hannay. Help yourself to scotch or brandy.
Thank you.
I think I'll have one of those.
What happened?
I apologize to the shade of Scudder. Karolithas was shot dead this evening, a few minutes after 7.
Good morning, Sir Walter.
Morning, Hannay. Hot dishes are over there. Kedgeree's rather good this morning. Help yourself to coffee, or Whittaker can bring tea if you'd rather.
I'll have coffee.
After you went to bed, I spent a busy hour on the telephone.
So you're already at work?
No, decoding a wire. Spoke to the First Sea Lord and the Secretary for War. They're bringing the Frenchman over today. This message confirms it. You know, for some odd reason, they've given him the code name Porker.
At least they've got things moving.
Yeah, I'm not sure it'll do any good. If your friends were clever enough to find out about the first arrangement, they'll discover the change soon enough. Give my head to know who's leaking them the information.
You've no idea at all.
Well, we thought there were only 5 men in England who knew about this visit. You can be sure there were even fewer in France. They manage things better over there. You drive a car, Hannay?
I did all right up in Galloway.
Well, you'll be my chauffeur for today. You've had a hand in this business from the beginning, and we're taking no risks. These are desperate men who are hardly likely to respect the country retreat of an overworked official. We'll drive up to town as soon as you're ready. Whittaker can bring the luggage by train.
10 minutes?
10 minutes.
We took the Bath Road and made good going. I landed Sir Walter at his house in Queen Anne's Gate by 11:30.
Thank you, Hannay. Now, I needn't tell you to keep deadly quiet and lie low. If one of our Black Stone friends were to spot you, there might be trouble.
Sir Walter...
Come and see me tomorrow, Hannay. I'd get some sleep if I were you. Good day.
I had lunch at the Savoy, and spent all afternoon walking the back streets of London. But when I dined in Jermyn Street, even the best part of a bottle of Burgundy did nothing to cheer me. I felt abominably restless. Here I was, a very ordinary fellow with no particular brains, yet I felt that I was somehow needed to see this thing through. I told myself it was sheer conceit, that four or five of the cleverest people in the Empire had the job in hand, yet a voice kept telling me to be up and doing, or I would never sleep easy again. The upshot was that I decided to walk over to Queen Anne's Gate. I might not be admitted, but at least it was worth a try. At the corner of Duke Street, I passed a group of young men in evening dress who had dined rather well. I recognized one of them, and before I could turn away, he recognized me. It was my old friend, Mr. Marmaduke Jopley.
God. It's the murderer! Here, you fellas, hold him! It's Annie!
He gripped my arm, and his friends crowded round. And though I was not looking for trouble, my ill temper made me play the fool.
Let me go, Jopley, or you'll be sorry.
I let you go once before, Hannay. I won't let it happen again.
What's this, gentlemen? What's the trouble?
Don't you recognize him, Constable? This is the man who did the Portland Place murder, and yes. I've got him safe.
Gentlemen, that's enough of that. Now then, Mr...
I tell you, that's Hannay. You saw him hit me. What more proof do you want that he's the killer?
Oh, shut up, Jopley. You don't know what you're talking about, as usual.
That'll do, sir. I think you'd better come along with me to the station.
I advise you to leave me alone, Constable, if you know what's good for you.
Take him off, Constable. He's a menace to society.
Scotland Yard knows all about me, officer. You'll get a proper wigging if you interfere.
Well, that's as may be, sir, but I saw you hit that gentleman cruel hard and him not doing a thing. Best come along with me, or will I have to fix you up?
Hey! Hey!
In a jiffy, I was in Pall Mall and going for St. James Park. I managed to dodge the policeman at the palace gates and put on a spurt. Once I was in the park itself, no one tried to stop me. I got to Queen Anne's Gate, which seemed almost deserted, and slowed to a walk. There were three or four cars outside Sir Walter's. I rang the bell, not knowing what I should do if the butler refused me entrance.
Whittaker.
Sir?
I must see Sir Walter. My business is desperately important.
Sir Walter is engaged at present, sir, and is not to be disturbed. But if you would care to wait...
Thank you.
Please sit down, sir. Is there anything I can get you?
What you can do, Whittaker, is put off anyone who comes to the door asking for me. I'm working with Sir Walter. He'll vouch for me.
I understand, sir. Leave it to me.
Yes? You've got Hannay the murderer in here. We've come to arrest him.
If you let me do the talking, sir...
We have reason to believe that a fugitive from justice has taken shelter here. Let us in, will you?
I'm afraid I can't do that, Constable.
Look here!
This is the house of Sir Walter Bullivant, Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Office. Sir Walter has given orders that I am to admit no one, and I can assure you I have no intention of contravening those orders. Good night, gentlemen.
Now, just one minute, my man!
Thank you, Whittaker.
Not at all, sir. I don't think they'll disturb us again.
Good night, then, Monsieur Loyer. General.
Good night, Alois.
Well, I'll be long. Glad we've got things sorted out. Whittaker.
Sir.
Lord Alois Colt.
At once, Sir Walter. We'll talk tomorrow, Bullivant. Good night.
Good night.
Here you are, my lord.
In the car outside.
Yes, sir.
Lord Alois' face was familiar to anyone who read a newspaper. As Whittaker helped him into his coat, he glanced in my direction. For a second, our eyes met. And it was enough to make my heart jump. Something sprang into those eyes, and that something was recognition. It was unmistakable, even though it came and was gone in a moment.
Good night, my lord.
Whittaker, where's the telephone?
This way, sir.
And the directory?
Here you are, sir. Holcroft, Woman Alloa.
Hello, Central. Mayfair 8151, please. It's rather urgent. Hello, Lord Alloa's residence. Is his lordship at home? Forgive me, but when did he return? Thank you. No. No message.
I still don't think the Germans...
Forgive me, General.
I am sorry to disturb you, gentlemen.
This is Mr. Hannay, of whom I have spoken to you. I'm afraid, Hannay, your visit is ill-timed.
That remains to be seen, sir. I think you may find I'm in the nick of time... Who left you a moment ago?
Lord Alloar. What about him?
He was not Lord Alloar.
What?
His living image, yes, but not the First Sea Lord. It was someone who recognized me, someone I've seen in the last month. He'd scarcely left the doorstep when I rang up Lord Alloa's house. I was told his lordship came in half an hour ago and had gone to bed.
Then who?
The Black Stone, Sir Walter. That's who.
I shall telephone Alloa myself. Excuse me.
And I was left alone with gentlemen who, whatever the greatness of their positions, were looking pretty badly scared.
This Black Stone of which you speak, Monsieur Honey.
Oh, I still think it's some nonsense of Scudder's. Clever fellow, no doubt of it, but not always reliable.
With the greatest respect, General, one may discount Scudder's prejudices, but I have found every one of his facts reliable.
Cryptic scribbles you can't make head or tail of. Schoolboy code names.
And who was it, General, who gave me the code name Porker?
Oh, I assure you, Monsieur Royer, that... Well, Bullivant?
I spoke to Alloa in person. Had to get him out of bed, very grumpy. He had dinner with Malross and went straight home afterwards.
Look here, I know Alloa as well as I know anyone. You're not telling me that I sat next to someone pretending to be him without noticing...
That's what's so clever about it, General. You took Lord Alloa's presence for granted. I'll bet you didn't even look at him.
Well, Monsieur Henney is correct. Our enemies have indeed been clever.
But if their object is to get our plans without our knowing it, why choose to impersonate Alloa, whom any of us might have spoken to beforehand?
Who better to impersonate than Alloa, who never says much? That shows you how well briefed they are.
All right. But if we have had a spy among us, how is he going to carry away all those facts and figures in his head? He'd never seen them before. He didn't take a note. I don't see what good it can have done him.
Well, one can train oneself to remember things as if one had taken a photograph. You notice he said little but went through the papers again and again. Mm. I would say he has them pretty well. When I was younger man, I too could do this trick.
Then I suppose the only thing we can do is change the plans.
Not without changing the geography of England.
Mm. And I spoke to him of the plans of my government. Such information would be worth many millions to our enemies. The man and his friends must be taken at once. This is the only way.
But we haven't the rag of a clue.
And they might have already communicated the plans by post.
Forgive me, General, but you do not understand the ways of the spy. He delivers in person what he knows and receives in person his reward. In France, we know something of the breed.
So there is still a chance?
Yes, Monsieur Hannay, if it is possible to watch all the ports and search all the ships. But we must do this for the sake of our two nations.
We cannot search everywhere in 24 hours.
Impossible. We have to narrow it down.
Ah, I know. Scudder's notebook.
Oh, more of that damn nonsense.
Where is it, Sir Walter? Quick, man, I think I remember something that may help us.
I have it here.
Thank you. Here we are. 39 steps. And here's another reference. 39 steps. I counted them. High tide, 10:17 p.m.
And what the devil's that supposed to mean?
Don't you see, General? Scudder knew where these fellows hid out, and he knew where they were going to leave the country, though he kept the name to himself.
Typical.
It's a place where high tide is at 10:17 p.m. tomorrow, the 15th of June.
Mm. What if they leave tonight?
They won't, General. I know Germans, and they're mad about working to a plan. They've got their routine, and they'll stick to it. What we need is a book of tide tables. That's where we should start.
I have one. On you go, Henny. You seem to have taken charge.
Of course, it could be any number of places.
How will we know?
The clue must lie in the steps. 39 steps.
Could it refer to a port?
I rather doubt it, Monsieur. 39, doesn't that sound more like a staircase? Perhaps one leading to the sea.
What if they were going to catch a steamer?
Well, easy enough to look up the sailings. They'll be in the paper.
Here we are. Now, there's no steamer sailing at 10:17 p.m. tomorrow, so that's out.
Look here. Of course, I'm only guessing.
Oh, can't run a war on guesswork, Henny.
Agreed, General, but if there's a riddle to be solved, my way of doing it, and I've had some success, is to use my brains as far as they go, and then when I come to a blank wall, I jump it with a guess. Mm. My guesses often turn out pretty right, General.
What do you guess, Monsieur Henny?
Let's write down what we're fairly sure of. There's a staircase. Perhaps several, one of which has 39 steps. It leads to a place from which they can only leave at high tide, which is 10:17. It's probably not a regular harbour.
Why not?
Do you know any harbour with 39 steps, General? Which means, and this is a guess, it's probably a stretch of open coast.
which would imply they were going in a small boat, a yacht, or launch, or even a trawler.
That still leaves a pretty wide field, Annie.
If you were a German in a hurry, where would you leave from? If you wanted a secret and speedy passage?
Not from any of the big ports, I agree.
Somewhere not too far from London, mm-hmm. since that is where he has started from.
So, that cuts out the Channel, Scotland, the West Coast.
Leaves the East Coast, doesn't it?
Exactly, General. Let's say you're aiming for Ostend, Antwerp, or Rotterdam. That'd get you closer to Germany. Where would you go from?
Well, you're the one playing Sherlock Holmes.
Not me, General. I told you, this is blind guesswork, not at all scientific. But if we look at a map of the East Coast, myself, I'd plump for a place between Cromer and Dover.
Why, in heaven's name?
Yes, I am content to trust Monsieur Hannay's instinct for the moment.
What we need is someone who knows that part of the coast. Sir Walter.
Hold on. I'll ring the Admiralty.
I'll come with you.
Brattlesome, you say? Hold on, Rathburn, and I'll tell him. Rathburn says there's a place in Norfolk, Brattlesome, beside a golf course. There are a couple of staircases to let people pick up their lost balls.
No, that's not it.
Yeah. Rathburn, we don't think that can be it. What? Marine Parades?
It'll be somewhere less public than that.
Hear that, Rathburn? What? Can't think of anything. Well, try, man. It's a matter of national importance. What? The Rough.
Where is it?
Describe it to us, Rathburn. Near Bradgate. Yes, Kent, I know. Chalky headland, lots of villas on top.
That sounds more like it.
Go on, Rathburn. He says it's a very high-toned sort of place. Mm-hmm. Residents like to keep to themselves. Lots of private staircases down to the beach.
Bradgate. Gate. High tide tomorrow, 10:27. Damn. Ask if he knows what time high tide is at the Rough, Sir Walter.
Rathbone, you heard that? Well? Thank you. High tide's 10 minutes before Bradgate.
I drove through the night, and a pink and blue June morning found me on the empty sands near Bradgate. A small destroyer was anchored not too far out, and the first thing I did was telegraph Sir Walter about it. Then I started climbing up and down the private staircases that led to the smart villas above. 36,
37, 38, 39, 40, 41. 21, 22, 23. 36, 37, 38, 39. Eureka.
I found out from the local estate agent that the house at the head of the 39 steps, Trafalgar Lodge it was called, belonged to a retired stockbroker called Appleton. I watched it all morning, and absolutely nothing happened to distinguish it from any of the other perfectly ordinary houses along the cliff top. But after lunch, my hopes were aroused by a smart white yacht, about 150 tons, that had anchored opposite the villa. I hired a small rowing boat, and under the guise of doing some fishing, I was able to have a closer look. Her name was the Ariadne.
Ahoy there! Afternoon! Think it'll rain? Maybe. Maybe not.
I thought the glass had fallen a bit as I came out.
Good hour.
Higgins!
Aye, sir.
Bosun wants you up.
Aye, sir.
You have a very fine boat, sir, I may say, sir. She looks extremely fast.
She is capable of speed when necessary.
He spoke English perfectly, too perfectly. And his collar, his jacket and tie never came out of England.
You've had good fishing?
I have, as you see. Plenty of cod about. You fish, sir.
Unfortunately, I do not get the time.
Shame, sir. Not here for long.
Sadly, that does not depend on me. Good day to you.
Goodbye.
I rowed back, still convinced I was on the right track, until it occurred to me that the man impersonating Lord Alloa last night might have seen that I recognized him. Somehow I doubted it, but if he had, maybe the Black Stone had changed their plans, despite what I had said about Germans sticking to their routine. I decided to put in another hour or two watching the house.
You might take pity of my age, Percy.
Oh, if I let up a fraction, Uncle, you'd beat me hollow.
An old chap I'd seen before lunch, taking a stroll, was playing a vigorous game of tennis with a plump young man. Nothing could have been more innocently English.
Oh, shot. I hope Elsie's bringing us a drink soon.
Oh, you can finish the set, surely. The best way I know of losing a few pounds. And I could do with that, even if you can't.
Try as I would, I found it hard to connect these two guileless citizens with the villains who had skewered Scudder to the floor and chased me all over Scotland. It seemed to me I'd set a trap for vultures and falcons and caught nothing but two plump thrushes. Then a third man arrived, a young chap in a bicycle.
There you fellows.
Bob, my dear chap, good to see you. Do you fancy a game?
You can take my place, Bob. The old man's worked me up into a proper lather.
What's the score?
One set all. It's not for me, I promise you. I'm for a tub.
No stamina. It's the trouble of the young men of today. Nay, Bob.
No, I don't all like Percy, Mr. Appleton.
I'll take you on tomorrow at the links, Bob. And give you a stroke of hope.
Well, let's all get in for a drink, eh? I've worked up a thirst. What about you, Bob?
You put a pot in front of me and I'll drink it.
Good, good. And Cook told me he's got a nice piece of salmon for his leg. Come along.
They all went into the house, leaving me feeling like a precious idiot. If they were acting, where was their audience? For how could they know I was sitting 30 yards off in a rhododendron bush? Who could believe they were anything but what they seemed, three ordinary suburban Englishmen? And yet, they were three, one old, one plump, one lean and dark. Their house chimed in with Scudder's notes, and nearby was anchored a yacht with at least one German officer aboard. I thought of Scudder and Karolides and all Europe trembling on the edge of an earthquake, and resolved to go forward as if I had no doubts. I made three telephone calls, ate a meagre dinner, and 9:30 found me walking up the path to Trafalgar Lodge. The ground floor windows were all open.
Don't hog the port, Percy.
Sorry, Uncle.
What about you, Bob?
I have time before my train. I'd be glad of another glass.
I rang the bell and gave my card to a trim parlourmaid. I had hoped to surprise them into dropping their disguise, but I have to say that neat, middle-class suburban house with its golf clubs and polished brass completely defeated me. When the maid showed me to the candle-lit dining room, I hadn't an ounce of confidence left.
You wish to see me, Mr. Hannay? Shall we go into the smoking room, or would you like to join us in a glass of port?
We have met before, I think. I imagine you know my business.
My memory is no longer what it was, I'm afraid. You'd better tell me what you've come for I haven't the faintest idea.
Well, then, I've come to tell you that the game's up. I have here a warrant for the arrest of you three gentlemen.
Arrest? Good God, what for?
For the murder of Franklin Scudder in London on the 23rd day of last month.
Scudder? I've never even heard the name before.
I have, Uncle. It was the Portland Place murder. I read about it in the papers.
Yes.
Mr. Hannay, you must see that this is a ridiculous charge. Where'd you come from?
Scotland Yard.
Scotland Yard, but...
Oh, don't get flustered, Uncle. This is a terrible mistake, but such things happen sometimes. We can easily show we're innocent. Now, on the 23rd, I was out of the country. Bob was in a nursing home, and you, Uncle, though you were in London... Well, you explained to Mr. Hannay what you were doing.
The 23rd? Oh, wasn't that the day after Agatha's wedding? Of course it was. I went up to town in the morning and lunched at the club with old Charlie Simons. And then I dropped in on Pam Davis for tea. She'd made me promise I would. And then, I dined at the Fishmonger's. I remember the punch didn't agree with me. So the next morning I was pretty seedy. Hang it all. There's a cigar box I brought back with me.
I think Mr. Hannay must realize he is mistaken. Of course, like all good citizens, we want to do whatever we can to uphold law and order. But we wouldn't want Scotland Yard making complete fools of themselves. Mr. Appleton?
Quite right, Bob. Quite right.
And to think I said you'd die of boredom if you moved here.
Oh, by Jove, yes. I say, it's quite a story to tell the club, eh?
It was all too confoundedly genuine. My heart went into my boots, and my first impulse was to apologize and clear out. But I told myself I must see it through, even though I was to be the laughingstock of Britain. The light from the dinner table candlesticks was not very good, and to cover my confusion, I got up and turned on the electric light. The sudden glare made them blink, and I stood scanning the three faces. I made nothing of it. There was nothing in their appearance to prevent them being the three who had hunted me in Scotland, but there was nothing to identify them. They seemed exactly what they professed to be, and I could not have sworn to one of them.
Well, Mr. Hannay, are you reassured?
Mr. Appleton...
It really is a bit thick, you know.
We could ask to see your warrant, I suppose. Not that I wish to cast any aspersions on you.
Why don't you march us all off to the local police station to be done with it? If not, I've got a train to catch.
Really, Bob, we must let Mr. Hannay make up his own mind.
He looked steadily at me, and I suddenly saw his eyelids fall in that hawk-like hood that fear had stamped on my memory. The three faces seemed to change before my eyes and reveal their secrets. The young one was the murderer. Now I saw cruelty and ruthlessness, where before I had only seen good humour. His knife, I meant certain, had skewered Scudder to the floor. His kind had put the bullet in Carolides. The plump man's features seemed to dissolve and form again as I looked at them. He hadn't a face, only 100 masks that he could assume when he pleased. The chap must have been a superb actor. Perhaps he had been Lord Alloa of the night before. Perhaps not. It didn't matter. I wondered if he was the fellow who had first tracked Scudder and left his card on him. Scudder had said he lisped, and I could imagine how the adoption of a lisp might add terror. But the old man was the pick of the lot.
Well, Mr. Hannay, what do you propose to do?
I reached in my pocket. In an instant, the lights were out. But before the men I had stationed in the grounds could come to my aid, my enemies leapt to their feet, and one of them gripped me from behind, preventing me from using my pistol.
Schnell, Franz! Das Boot! Das Boot!
The youngest of the three leapt through the window and made for the 39 steps. I grappled the old chap in the room full of policemen. Franz was followed, but I could see him get clean away across the moonlit lawn. And then my prisoner broke from me and flung himself at a switch on the wall.
Be safe. The steps are blown. You cannot follow now. He's on the Ariadne, and you will never catch him. The Black Stone has triumphed.
His eyes flamed with pride, and I realized that he was more than a spy. In his foul way, he had been a patriot. But as we handcuffed him, I had the last word.
I hope France will bear his triumph well. But I shall tell you, sir, that the Ariadne has been in our hands for the last hour.
Take them away.
Seven weeks later, as all the world knows, we went to war. I joined the new army the first week, and owing to my Matabele experience, got a captain's commission straight off. But I had done my best service, I think, before I put on khaki.
In The 39 Steps by John Buchan, Richard Hannay was played by David Rintoul. The other parts were played by Jimmy Chisholm, Michael Elder, Crawford Logan, David McHale, Alexander Morton, Sandy Nielsen, and John Shedden. The 39 Steps was dramatised for radio by Peter Buckman and directed in our Glasgow studios by Patrick Rayner.